Well, hello and welcome to the Smells Like Money podcast. Join me, Suzanne Chin Taylor, the doo-doo diva, as I interview guests who are making an impact on how we manage and operate systems for conveying and treating wastewater. As a veteran of the wastewater, trenchless, and civil infrastructure industry, each week I'll be bringing you industry know-how from industry pros who know how. Join me each week as I speak with representatives of organizations that are utilizing disruptive or new technologies and methods, and executives who are excited to share how to be successful and sustainable in our vital industry. So whether you want to learn about the latest trends in technology, in treatment or trenchless, gain tips on training and retaining great talent, or simply how to be more efficient, productive, or profitable, this podcast is for you. Ready? Let's dive right in. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode of the Doo-Doo Divas Smells Like Money podcast. Today, we are visiting with Andy Campbell, who is part of the supplier development team at Sourcewell. And if you're unfamiliar with what Sourcewell does, they are a purchasing cooperative. And some of you who are listening may be very familiar with this term because it's been around for quite a while. But we're going to discuss some of the advantages, I don't want to say disadvantages, but how to work with a purchasing cooperative, why a municipality or the buyer should work with one, why you as a vendor should be involved with one, how that process works, and just anything and everything about purchasing cooperatives. And so welcome to the show, Andy.
Thanks for having me, Susan. I appreciate it.
Well, the way we got connected was Sourcewell. I know you've been around for a while, but when I was at the WET show in 2023 in Indianapolis, I started noticing, and you know, I'd been aware of, you know, Texas Buy Board and their logo, and what was the other one? HGAC Buy, and seeing the signs all over the place. And I started to see these cute little flags on every vendor's or a lot of the vendor's table, you know, available through Sourcewell. And I was like, oh, well, what's that? And so I made it a point to look you up on the, you know, on the booth registry and to visit with you for a few minutes, and knew that I had to bring you onto the show, as, you know, you've got a slightly different approach to purchasing cooperatives, similar, but different. And so I would really like for you to tell the folks a little bit about how Sourcewell came about, and a little history on the company, and maybe what makes you a little bit different than some of those other players that have been in our industry for a long time.
Sure. Well, again, thanks for having me, Susan. It's a pleasure to join you today. So Sourcewell was created in 1978 by the Minnesota legislature. Our roots are as a service cooperative. I would say one of the things that is most maybe misunderstood about us is that we actually are a government agency. I'm a public employee, just like all of my colleagues are. And I can get into this a little bit deeper later on, but that's actually kind of the straw that stirs the drink. Without our governmental status, we wouldn't be able to do cooperative purchasing. And so, again, kind of going back to the late 70s, so we've been doing this for a very long time. We were created by our state legislature and granted the legislative authority to engage in cooperative purchasing. And that's just one of the many services that we provide, but it is definitely the one that we're most known for from a national perspective. You mentioned our fun flags. That's a huge credit to our marketing department. They came up with the idea a number of years ago, but it definitely helps draw interest, and it certainly piqued your curiosity as well to come speak to us. But cooperative purchasing is one of those not new things, but surprisingly, it's new to a lot of people. As I mentioned, it's been around for a very long time, but there's been kind of two significant historical events that have happened in the last 20 years that have really kind of fast-forwarded or spun up the popularity of cooperative purchasing. The first historical event was the Great Recession in 2008-2009 timeframe. It was around that time that public agencies really started to feel a pinch in their budgets because the economy had crashed, tax revenues were down, and you started to see a lot of procurement departments really either not rehiring people that had retired, or you know, ultimately had to shift people around, and it just, those procurement departments were really being forced to do more and more with less and less. And cooperatives really kind of came into much more broader use at that time, just simply because I think in a lot of cases, people were forced to look at cooperatives as just a safety net to say, look, we don't have the staff on hand to do all of these bids. We need to go somewhere else. And then the second historical event was COVID. Again, you started to see a lot of isolation happening. And I think what you saw was just a need for procurement departments to get very creative with how they do their jobs. And but I would also kind of marry that with not only these two significant events, but specifically in the fleet and the public works spaces. You have leaders in those industries that arguably in no other public sector departments do you have such a desire for very specific brands of equipment and vehicles. These individuals very much understand the value of uptime, standardization, quality, and they also understand a significant difference between cost and price and in how their departments need to work. Because, hey, look, if our city's wastewater and our city's fleets and all of those other related teams and departments aren't doing their job, the community knows it and they say something about it, right? And so these managers and these directors, they understand the value of making sure that their teams are constantly able to do their jobs with the equipment, tools, and resources that they need. And not always is a bid going to end up giving them the end result that they want. And so it's been
a low bid scenario. Yeah, that low bid does not mean the best solution.
Exactly. And so you've got this group, this population of public employees who just, when they learned about, you know, Sourcewell and they learned about cooperative purchasing in general and how it could be so effective and helpful in getting them the solutions they want while still getting procurement the compliance that they need, it was like a win-win for them. And so that group has almost single-handedly also really pushed and made a huge effort in getting cooperative purchasing more broadly accepted.
So let me kind of go back on this. This, if I'm understanding it correctly, if they decide to use a service like this, and they've, let's say a team, collection systems, a team goes out and starts looking at CCTV trucks or a combination truck, and they demo it and they decide, okay, this is the one we want, because this is going to do the job that we do need to do for our particular scenario.
Yep.
They can then avoid having to put together a bid and send it out and have to accept something that they don't want if they go through a purchasing cooperative?
If you really just had to boil it down to a yes or no question, yes, the answer to that is yes. Now, there's a lot more involved there. But yes, essentially the idea behind using a purchasing cooperative is that you don't have to duplicate the bid process. One thing that we say often, especially to our supplier community, is don't say you can skip the bid, because that's not what using a cooperative purchasing contract is about. It's about satisfying those bidding requirements without having to necessarily do it yourself. So okay. We're not skipping, we're not avoiding. What we're doing, if we're skipping or avoiding anything, it's duplication.
Okay.
Sourcewell has already, or other purchasing cooperatives, we've already conducted the competitive bid process. So it's that process that we've already done that is now going to satisfy your local needs. So to use your example, if that public works department is looking at buying a CCTV truck or a sewer back truck, they know exactly the brand they want. If I'm a public works director, or if I'm in that leadership role, the very first step that I want to do, or the one of the very first questions I'm going to ask that dealer or that salesperson is, do you have a cooperative contract? Because if I know that in advance, now I can be letting my procurement department know in advance. You don't want to just spring it on them, but you're giving them a notice to say, hey, we've begun the research process on determining what is the right combination truck for us, the right CCTV truck or whatever it is you're buying. And we have found that the potential candidates all have cooperative contracts. Now, whether they all have a Sourcewell contract, or, you know, this one has a Sourcewell, this one has an HGAC, or this one has, you know, a buy board, or whomever the cooperative might be, it's really about letting that procurement department know in advance, so they have time to now process that and say, all right, yep, we've worked with Sourcewell, we're good to go, everything is fine. As long as they have a Sourcewell contract, we're good. Or maybe cooperative procurement might be kind of a new concept to that procurement department. And you never just want to spring it on them. You got to give them opportunities to do their own due diligence and understand, all right, hey, I've got a publicly elected commission or board or council that I have to report this to. I have to do my research. I have to do my due diligence. I have to make sure that all my I's are dotted and T's are crossed. But that's really kind of what it is all about.
Well, then let's dive into that, because one of the things that there's some big misunderstandings, and one of the terms that you hear bantered about, and, you know, when we were offline before we came on the show, I brought it up and you made that great distinction. I'd like you to do that for our audience. We hear a lot in this realm, the term piggybacking, and explain. And I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding about what that really means, how it can be used, and maybe how that compare and contrast to what we're talking about here of a vendor being part of a cooperative contract. And then I want to go into that and have you really explain what does being part of a purchasing cooperative contract mean, and what does it entail for the vendor to get on that contract?
Sure.
I know that's a long question, but it's all kind of wrapped in, they kind of are interchangeable and they work together. So
yeah, you bet. Well, I'll do my best to unpack all that. So if I miss on something there,
we'll repeat it, no problem.
Yeah, bring it back around for me. But you're right. The phrase or the term piggybacking, a lot of people use it. A lot of people have different definitions of it. So what I'm about to tell you is really kind of more like kind of our perspective on this. Doesn't make us the right ones in this, but I would say there's kind of some generally accepted definitions for it. So the true definition of a piggyback, and I'm just going to use Municipality A and Municipality B as our guinea pigs here. So Municipality A goes out and does a bid, a true bid, for one sewer combination truck, okay? They've spec'd it, they've done everything, they've gone through their process, they've awarded, and they've made their purchase. In that bid, they inserted language granting permission for other municipalities to use their bid to satisfy their own bidding requirements. That's where Municipality B comes into play and say, all right, Municipality A bought the same kind of truck that we want. We want to use their bid so we don't have to do it, so we can get this order in and get it delivered much, much sooner than if we were to go through a bid. We're adding easy 6 to 9 months to our lead time. So they want to get things done faster. So they're going to piggyback off of Municipality A's bid. But The catch there is, if they're going to do a true piggyback, Municipality B doesn't get to choose their options. They have to buy the identical truck using the identical specification that Municipality A used when they bought it in a true piggyback form. The only difference is going to be Municipality B might have a different freight charge because of where they're located or something, but the actual truck itself, same chassis, same body, same options. Literally, they are buying a clone of what Municipality A bought.
Got it.
And what has happened over the years is just this idea, this concept of one government agency using another government agency's bid. That term piggybacking has kind of gotten diluted, maybe is the right word to say. And a lot of different people, you know, start to use different meanings of that. But for the purposes of our discussion and kind of our feelings on this, a true piggyback is that you are buying the identical thing. Now, Sourcewell contracts are very different from that. The idea of using our solicitation process to satisfy yours, that's kind of where the similarities end. But what our contracts allow, because our contracts, for example, and actually, by the way, most, if not all, cooperatives are this way as well. Our contracts are indefinite quantity. So we're not going out for one widget with one specification for one transaction. We are looking at an entire catalog of solutions that any one respondent might have. And again, it's indefinite quantities. So we're not, in our RFP, we're not saying we want four trucks. We're, you know, it's indefinite quantity. And then again, it's not a specification-based bid. It's a solution-based RFP or request for proposal. So there's a very distinct difference between an invitation for bid, IFB, or a request for proposal, RFP. An IFB is a specification-based document and process, and it's a race to the basement. Who is going to come in with the lowest responsible? That word has now been thrown into a lot of bids, the lowest responsible bidder. Whereas an RFP is best value. You can start to evaluate way more than just price. So an IFB, like I said, it's a race to the basement. As long as you can meet these specifications for this one item, all we're evaluating is your price. In an RFP, we're looking at way more factors. You know, what's your warranty? What's your ability to sell and service nationally? What is the depth and breadth of your product line? Are you coming in with one model or are you coming in with 30 models? Are you considered best in class in your category or your industry? And you could show us that by your marketplace successes as well as your market share. I mean, there's so many other factors that we can evaluate in an RFP. And then we can award a contract on a multi-year term. Because it's indefinite quantity, it's for this four-year term with optional potential extensions, it's a hunting license. So in other words, our membership from all over North America can access all of your dealers and use one contract. So the difference there between that RFP and an IFB is significant when it terms the scale and scope of who can buy off of it and what can they buy off of it. So I realize that kind of really evolved from the piggybacking conversation, but I think all of that is kind of interrelated.
Right. Well, that leads a question when you said about, you mentioned the word dealers. So let's say you have a manufacturer of a said piece of equipment. They do some direct sales, but they also do sales through distributors because of where they're located. That distributor does the sales, the service, the parts.
Yes.
Is their distributor, you know, their exclusive distributor in, let's say they're based in Illinois, but they have a distributor in California. Can that California distributor of their line, use the cooperative purchasing contract for a customer in California that wants to buy.
Yeah, is absolutely.
Manufacturer connected, not is it manufacturer based or is it entity based, like distributor based?
So I would say from Sourcewell's perspective, I don't want to speak for the other cooperatives, but I think everybody kind of follows the same model. But again, I'll speak specifically for Sourcewell. We generally attempt to pursue manufacturer contracts because then with one contract, it can be made available to their entire distribution model.
Excellent.
So that doesn't mean that we preclude dealers from responding. Not at all. If they want to respond to an open solicitation, it's open to everyone to respond to. But when we're having conversations, we do tend to focus more on manufacturers because, again, you've got one manufacturer with one potential contract available to their entire distribution. If the factory didn't respond and they left it up to their dealers to respond, you would end up with all these pockets of territories that would be unserved because it's not realistic that if a manufacturer has 70 dealers, all 70 are going to respond and all 70 are going to get contracts, right? And so generally the accepted practice is to pursue a factory or a manufacturer to do the response. And then in their response, it's very clear for Sourcewell contracts, you know, you need to identify, are you a reseller or are you a manufacturer? What is your sales process? Are you involving dealers in this response? So it's very clear in their response, yes, although we are the manufacturer, we do not sell direct. We use independently owned and operated dealers, and they are a part of this. But we also have manufacturers, to use your initial example, some manufacturers take a hybrid approach where depending on the geographic location, it might be a direct sale for them because they don't have dealers in that area, or they may have dealers. And that would also be incorporated into their response in terms of, hey, I'm a customer, I'm reading this contract, how do I know who to cut my PO to? Well, clearly states right here, oh, I'm in Arkansas and I see in the contract Arkansas is a direct sale state for them. Okay, so it looks like I'm cutting my PO directly to the factory. Or, oh, I'm in Florida. I see they have a dealer here. So yes, it looks like I'll be cutting my PO directly to the dealer because it says clearly in their contract. Or the third option might be there's no dealers whatsoever. Maybe a manufacturer, that's just their go-to-market strategy. They're a direct sale organization. They have salespeople all over the country. They have service centers all over the country as well, and it's a direct sale. So it's really kind of a rainbow of fruit flavors, so to speak, in terms of it really depends on who's responding and how their company is set up.
Right. Well, that leads me to the question of are these types of contracts being used primarily for equipment procurement, or could they also be utilized for capital improvement projects or services such as inspection and cleaning and like be sold on a linear foot?
I know, great question. In fact, I'll go back to, you know, some of our humble roots. Our very first contract was with Sharp Copiers. So okay, Sourcewell has over 600 contracts. And so we have everything ranging from the commodities, your office supplies, your technology, your computer peripherals, and, you know, copier machines and virtually MRO, everything in between. So the whole commodity side. And then we have a whole nother segment. We have over 14 categories of contracts at Sourcewell that make up those 600 contracts. From fire trucks and ambulances and a whole public safety segment to fleet and public works and almost everything in between. We have one of, if not the most robust catalog of contract categories in the cooperative space. There's probably not a lot that, especially at the municipal level, that you would need to buy for your city or your county or township that we don't have a contract for, where it has a, it's a very robust offering.
So what's involved to get on a contract? What should people expect, you know, work-wise, cost-wise, labor-wise, to be part of this, which leads into, you know, because there's so many cooperatives, does it make sense to get on all of them, or can you get done what you need to get done with just being part of, let's say, one or two? Because, like, I remember you saying there is quite a bit of, you know, paperwork and labor intensity to get on this.
So this would be misconception number two.
Okay.
The first one I said was, we're a government agency. It seems like so few people understand that fact. But the second misconception is, so many, especially on the supplier side, so many suppliers think that this is just simply an application process. Oh, it's just, I'm just filling out paperwork. That's all I'm doing, and I'm applying, and once I turn in my application, I'm good to go. Nothing could be further from the truth. This is a full-on, fair, open, transparent, and competitive solicitation process. So if you have, whether you have dealers or not, whenever your organization is responding to an individual bid, that identical process is what we're doing. We're okay. Still writing an RFP that you still need to read through and understand. There's still a supplier questionnaire that you have to respond and give us all of your responses. There's still pricing. So yes, it can be perceived as incredibly intensive, labor intensive, and time intensive with regards to what you have to invest in your response in order to put your best foot forward, because your answers are being scored. And those scores and what you ultimately achieve is going to determine whether or not you win a contract or not. So it is definitely not a application process. There is an incredible amount of thought, time, and preparation that needs to go in when responding to a cooperative contract, or specifically to a Sourcewell contract. Again, I don't want to speak for all the other cooperatives that exist out there. But with regards to strategy and your question about, well, should I be pursuing every single cooperative out there? That's really, I mean, your call to make. I don't know that I'm in a position to be telling you what you should or shouldn't do, but I will say this. I don't know that it makes a lot of sense from a time investment and, in, more importantly, an administrative oversight standpoint, to have dozens of cooperative contracts. In my professional advice, I would probably find two of the top cooperatives that you know have the broadest acceptance and reputation, and just kind
maybe of maybe even ones your customers like.
That I was just gonna say that right there as well, and say, where do your customers want to buy through?
Okay.
And asking them those questions and say, hey, you know, do you have a cooperative strategy when you buy? If you do, what is it? Who are you looking to? And you'll probably hear two cooperatives generally referenced the most, Sourcewell being one of them. But that's where I would start and say, okay, well, all of my customers mention these two or these three cooperatives, so it might be a good idea for you to pursue a contract with those three. If you can win them with all three, awesome. If you can only win it with two or even one, at least you're definitely on the way. But it doesn't make sense, again, especially from an administrative oversight, because keep in mind, let's say you have five cooperative contracts. Those are five sales reports, five admin fees, you've got to now train your whole distribution model on how to use five different co-ops. Your message can get diluted relatively quickly. So I would say, from my experience, the most successful organizations that take a multiple cooperative strategy cap it at two. They usually just stick with two cooperatives, two national cooperatives. That doesn't mean that they won't pursue a state contract or maybe a local or a regional cooperative, because those do exist as well. But from a national perspective, they don't normally pursue more than two.
Right. Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Thank you for that advice there. So as a vendor that has gotten onto one of these, you know, cooperatives, and they run into a customer that has never used this, how can they in the field, because this sounds like an absolutely fantastic platform for the buyer. You know, yes, there's an advantage to for the vendor, but it has more advantage for the buyer. They're the ones who are going to get the most benefit out of this. How can they help them learn more about this? How can they encourage them to utilize this process, which can actually save them time and effort and help them to ensure that they're, like we said at the very, very beginning, to help them make sure that they get the things that they really want and not be stuck with the thing that came in at the lowest price?
Well, here's the good news, is that when I started doing this in 2008, it was not very widely known. And so that concern that you just brought up right now was definitely one that was a much higher priority, is just the education piece. Fast forward to 2023 now, and have been swapped. Those that aren't using or those that are unaware of it are most definitely in the minority now. I would say the vast majority of procurement people across this country are very aware that cooperatives exist. Running into those that have never heard of it is definitely becoming less and less the norm.
That they've heard of it, but they've never explored it because maybe they have a misconception about, oh, well, our city council has always made us do bids, and they don't they've heard of it, but they don't understand that it's equal to what they've been doing in the past.
Sure. Well, there is There is a reality that we have to acknowledge here, and that is that there are pockets around this country where the laws haven't caught up with the best practices around the country yet. So there absolutely are people in procurement that are hamstrung. Like, there's no way around it, because their local policy hasn't been updated, or it could be a law. There's a difference between policy and law, but those just haven't been updated yet. And yes, there are absolutely publicly elected officials that are very much of the mindset that it's got to be low bid, low bid, low bid. And again, thankfully, I would say the message of the difference between cost and price has really finally started to penetrate to the elected official level too, because of the tireless efforts of these public employees teaching and providing stone cold fact to these officials to say, look, we went low bid previously, and this is what we got, because we were so focused on price, not cost. And so you're starting to see this education piece. Now, to go back to your question, however, if I'm a vendor and I'm talking to a potential customer, there's a couple of realities that we have to kind of have a look ourselves in the mirror moment. And the first reality am I absolutely 100% certain this customer wants to buy from me? Because if the customer is not really wanting to buy from you, your cooperative contract isn't going to be the thing that changes their mind.
Okay.
So we tell our suppliers all the time, sales 101 is not gone away. Like, we still have to make sure that you as a salesperson are still doing your job, building that relationship, building trust and rapport, doing your demos, making sure that you've done everything within your power to ensure that that customer has been convinced that their problem, you have the solution to, and that they should be buying from you. Once and if that has been done, then the next logical step in that process is asking the question, how do you buy? Now, this is another, probably we could maybe call this the third misunderstanding with cooperative purchasing, is that people have a tendency to unnecessarily overcomplicate cooperative purchasing. I am by no means attempting right now to belittle or denigrate the value of the public procurement space. I want to be very clear with this. But every day, public procurement comes to the office every day. And if we had to just completely boil it down to its most fundamental level, procurement is asking, what do I have to buy today? And how am I going to buy it? So they've got a stack of requisitions on their desk from all the departments saying, I need. All right, here is what am I going to buy? And in the public procurement space, the how are they going to buy it? It's a very simple two questions. Are you going to bid it or are you going to buy off of a contract? Those are the only two options in the United States. If what I'm going to buy exceeds a bid threshold, those are my two choices. So if as a salesperson, you can have the conversation then with procurement and say, what is your strategy for the how am I going to buy it question? If you are a bid only city, county, township, school district, whatever, the logical question here is, why are you a bid only? Is it a law? Is it a policy? Is it a perceived policy? You have to kind of do your homework to understand what is driving the decision to say, we're bidding this. Because the answer to that is going to then open up all the other doors to using your cooperative contract and first understanding how that customer buys. Because if it's a policy or a law, you've got much bigger things that we need to start working on, and it really has to be driven internally by that city, by that county, to change that perception. And to say, and the good news is that a cooperative like Sourcewell can provide the salesperson with resources to show that city, wow, we are totally in the minority here. Every community within a 50-mile radius of us is using cooperative purchasing. Why aren't we? You know, so then in the public space, nobody wants to be first, but nobody wants to be left behind, because that's how you end up in the newspaper the next day, and nobody wants to be there either. So when if I'm a purchasing person, or if I'm even an elected official for my city or county, and I'm learning about this wonderfully efficient way to procure that is happening all around us and we're not, I would logically ask the question, why is that? Is it just cronyism because this is the way it's always been done and we're not going to change? So then you need somebody to challenge the status quo. But the good news is, again, I think we've evolved significantly as a country to where cooperative purchasing is becoming so far more broadly accepted. But for the salesperson that does still run into those people, that's where they want to get their cooperative involved and say, hey, can you help me? Do you guys have any experience working with this municipality? Because I've had this situation. I had a supplier who had a significant opportunity, six-figure opportunity to sell a product into a municipality. And it was just that particular buyer was saying, no, we can't do this. Well, when they approached me and said, hey, can you help me understand, you know, has this city ever bought through Sourcewell before? And we could look into our internal sales reporting and say, well, that's interesting because that municipality has spent tens of millions of dollars on 14 different Sourcewell contracts. I'm surprised that one buyer would push back. Well, you know what we ultimately learned, Susan? That person had been on the job for 4 months and had no idea that their employer even embraced cooperative purchasing. So when it was brought to that buyer's attention, they brought it to their boss, and the boss was like, oh, our bad. You know what? We just haven't even had time to tell you about that yet. Came back to the supplier, and it was a done deal that same day. Six-figure PO was cut. So that's also not an uncommon situation where you'll be dealing with one individual who doesn't realize that they can and that everyone else in their organization is on board with it.
Well, that is a perfect place, I think, for us to leave off and just, you know, helping people. What was that line for that movie? Help me help you.
100%.
Help me help you. And so for those of you who are listening that would like to learn more about Andy's company, how can they get that information?
Well, obviously our website's a great place to go. It's just www.sourcewell-mn.gov.
G-O-V. And they can connect with you on LinkedIn at Andy Campbell?
Yes, absolutely.
All right. Well, again, thank you for being on the show and sharing all these insights. You know, I learned a lot about my own misconceptions because many, many years ago, I was responsible for doing the paperwork or part of the paperwork on a cooperative bid. And it was hard to understand, but you've made this, the whole concept of this, a lot easier to digest. So thank you for sharing your wisdom with us, Andy. And for those of you listening, thank you for tuning in. And until next time, keep it flowing. Thanks so much for joining me, the Doo-Doo Diva, on this week's episode of Smells Like Money. What stood out to you this week? Share your takeaways by leaving me a review. You can find out more about the new technologies, creating sustainable solutions, and insights on how to succeed in our vital industry by subscribing to the show. Whether you want to learn about the latest trends in wastewater infrastructure, treatment, or trenchless, you've got it all right here at Smells Like Money. If you're an industry expert and would like to be considered as a guest for the show, book a quick chat with me by visiting calendly.com/thetuitgroup/b-a-podcast-guest, or simply click the link in the show notes below. Until next week, a big shout out to all my industry friends and those who will be. You are my superheroes. Thanks for tuning in, keeping it flowing, and we'll see you all next week.